So good evening. Let me introduce Catherine Jellison, who is professor at OYO. How are you? OYO in French, but how are you in English? University in Athens, in the United States, and not in Greece. And past president of the Agricultural History Society. She is honoring us with her presence. I recall first that the Agricultural Society is celebrating the 100th anniversary of its birth in 1919, and it was the first society on the field. It's important to know this point. Catherine Jellison is chair of the Rural Women's Studies Association, chair of Ohio University's Department of History. She received numerous social grants and fellowships for her research, and she is the recipient of numerous awards at Ohio University. I am very happy, and we are very happy, to welcome her, and I will say it was a very important pleasure to organize her stay and to prepare her talk. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you for all, because we appreciate that you not only immediately accepted to take part to this conference and to come here with a long trip, but to got very involved in the program so that she made a double proposal for very interesting panels and decide to hold the meeting of our WSA here during our conference. Catherine is the author of a book, It's Our Day, Americans' Love Affair with a White Wedding, 1945-2005, published in 2008, where she was studying the American First Ladies, starting from Mrs. Bush and Mrs. Obama. But she published too another book some years ago, a very important book, entitled To Power, Farm Women and Technology, 1913-1963, where she examined Midwestern farm women's reaction to new labor-saving devices and evolution of farming. So, she is an expert on women in history, and she has devoted her research to issues of gender and consumer culture, focusing primarily on the 20th century. A specialist of this important, very new, important topic, she will give now a lecture on the theme, from the Palatinate to Pennsylvania, gender relations, and the new agriculture in Europe and North America. We shall therefore listen to her conference with the highest interest. Please, Catherine. It's up to you.
Merci beaucoup to Gerard and Federico and their wonderful graduate students who have been so helpful this week. I've had a wonderful time at the conference so far. And when Gerard said he had invited me to do this presentation, and I immediately accepted, as I've been telling people back in Ohio, Gerard made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Well, David Dannenbaum got that. He's a Godfather fan. So a reference to American pop culture. The opportunity to deliver the keynote address at this conference in this beautiful lecture hall is really one of the crowning achievements of my career. So thank you for this opportunity. And I think that by inviting me here, you have strengthened the connections between the Agricultural History Society and Euro, and that's a wonderful thing. And I have promised the present president of the Agricultural History Society, Deborah Reed, that I would announce that proposals for panels and papers are still being accepted until September 28th for the next meeting of the Agricultural History Society, which will be in early June 2020 in Knoxville, Tennessee. And so I hope I hope to see you there, Gerard, and many of the other wonderful people I've met this week. So thank you for this marvelous opportunity. Well, from the Palatinate to Pennsylvania. In his 1682 agricultural advice book, titled in English, Careful Husbandry Improved, Wulf Helmhard von Holberg set forth the ideal working relationship for wives and husbands who headed rural households in German-speaking early modern Europe. As he said, a household without a woman is like a day without sunlight, a garden without flowers, a lake without fish. Without her assistance, an economy can never be undertaken and carried on in proper order. The household will malfunction if the marriage partners do not help one another harmoniously. Holberg, member of a noble Protestant family, had fled Catholic Austria to establish new landholdings among other Protestant exiles in Bavaria's Upper Palatinate. He wrote his guidebook for people like himself, well-educated aristocrats. All socioeconomic levels of the agrarian hierarchy, however, from manor lords to peasants, would have recognized and appreciated the interdependence of male and female labor during this period of agricultural innovation in West Central Europe. Yet, at a time when literacy and the ability to publish accounts of rural life were the preserve of the elite, upper-class men, like Holberg, provide the only extant appraisals of the era's new agriculture, with its crop diversification and crop rotation, and also of the system's gender relations. This raises the question of how well elite advice matched the reality on the farm fields of West Central Europe. Possible insight into the central role that women's work and cooperation between the sexes played in the new agriculture's success may be gleaned from the experiences of the Old Order Amish of southeastern Pennsylvania, the descendants of early modern agriculturalists who migrated to North America only 45 years after the publication of Holberg's treatise. Over the years, the Pennsylvania Amish would selectively adopt a number of new customs while also retaining the most salient features of early modern agrarian life. Characteristics of the early modern new agriculture included subsistence farming with some market participation, crop diversification, the care of large numbers of animals, and the maintenance of soil fertility through the planting of legumes and the application of manure. Like the system of periodically fallow fields and limited animal husbandry that it replaced, the new agriculture was based on patriarchal authority over the household labor force. The new agriculture's increased crop productivity, however, placed a greater premium on the labor of all household members. In southwest Germany's Palatinate, in Baden, in Alsace, and in other areas where the new agriculture emerged, the agricultural household was, seemingly contradictorily, both hierarchical and team-based. The male head of household held ultimate authority, but he and his wife, along with their children and any servants, recognized that the household survival relied on the interdependence of male and female work and master-servant labor. Men and boys labored in the fields with horses and oxen, while women and girls worked in the house, the garden, the poultry yard, and the dairy. When the agricultural cycle demanded it, female members of the household crossed gender role boundaries to work alongside men and boys during planting, harvest, and haying seasons. In contrast, men and boys rarely took on prescribed female tasks. The other major task, of course, for adult women was to add to the household labor force through childbirth. Within this system of complementary male and female labor, the male household head supervised the work of other men and boys, while his female counterpart managed the work of women and girls. between the 16th and 18th century, common nomenclature in German-speaking Europe reflected the economic interdependence of male and female household heads, with the man designated as Hausvater, or father of the household, and the woman as Hausmutter, or mother of the household. The Amish brought these practices with them to Pennsylvania in the early 1700s. The Amish relocated to Pennsylvania in the early 18th century because of the religious upheavals that shook Central Europe two centuries earlier. Like the Mennonites and other European Anabaptists or rebaptizers who emerged from the Reformation, the Amish faced persecution from Catholics as well as mainstream Protestants who disapproved of Anabaptists' embrace of adult baptism and their pacifism and their rejection of state churches and rejection of participation in civil government. Their status as religious dissidents precluded Amish land ownership in the Palatinate and other European locations that allowed them residence. Relegated to isolated rented properties, the Amish necessarily relied on the labor of their own family members and experimented with techniques such as crop rotation and manure application in order to make their marginal farmlands thrive. In other words, the innovations engendered by their persecution put them in the vanguard of the new agriculture that through trial and error eventually spread throughout Central and Western Europe. Excuse me. Despite being sought after farm tenants and exemplars for other agriculturalists, the Amish continued to face religious discrimination and the fear that Central Europe's growing armies would take their young men into military service. Ultimately, many assimilated into other Protestant faiths or left Europe altogether, heading for North America, where they initially settled in the British colony of Pennsylvania. There, in a colony founded by another religious pacifist, the Quaker William Penn, they found a hospitable location to practice their faith and a climate and terrain similar to what they had known in Europe. In colonial Pennsylvania, the Amish could now own their own farmland and apply to it the methods of the new agriculture. And for those of you who don't know where Pennsylvania is, I've conveniently put it in red on this map. Upon their arrival in southeastern Pennsylvania, the Amish established their new homes in a region where inhabitants had long tilled the soil. The Susquehannock and other indigenous peoples of the area had grown corn, beans, and squash, the three sisters of Native American agriculture. They'd done this for many generations prior to European conquest and occupation. Within the First Peoples Division of Labor, women were the agriculturalists, and with their infants in cradle boards and other young children playing nearby, female work groups cultivated the three sisters communally. Men supplemented the plant diet that women provided with protein procured through hunting and fishing. European takeover of Susquehannock, Delaware, Seneca, and other tribes' lands permanently altered Pennsylvania's landscape and its agriculture. And this is an 18th century view of the area around Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Viewing the colony as an outpost of Western and West Central Europe, the English, Scots, Irish, Swedes, Dutch, Swiss, and various German-speaking migrants who preceded the Amish in Pennsylvania transplanted their new agriculture to American soil. The newcomers cultivated numerous vegetables, fruits, and grains, and they raised fowl and large livestock for meat, egg, and dairy protein. In contrast to Native Americans, however, the Europeans practiced agriculture both to feed themselves and to produce for the market economy. And unlike their indigenous predecessors, the colonizers divided the land into privately owned parcels and farmed it as members of individual family units rather than communally in single-sex labor groups. Perhaps most significantly, they considered men, not women, the primary agriculturalists. Now, while family farming was already the norm in colonial Pennsylvania by the time the Amish arrived, their almost exclusive dependence on family labor would set them apart from many of their neighbors. With their history of persecution in Europe and a theology that taught them to separate themselves from worldly influences, the Amish and other Anabaptists remained wary of outsiders. Amish families might hire one another's youngsters to perform farm work on a temporary basis, but they resisted engaging any long-term non-Amish help. Their frugality, wariness of outsiders, and history of relying primarily on family workers also caused the Amish largely to refrain from contracting indentured labor, which was a key labor source for many of the colony's other farm families. In Pennsylvania, Amish families' agricultural know-how and diligent labor soon earned them the praise of colonial officials. By 1738, Lieutenant Governor George Thomas was already remarking that Pennsylvania had been, in his words, for some years the asylum of the distressed Protestants of the Palatinate and other parts of Germany, and I believe it may with truth be said that the flourishing of Pennsylvania is in great measure owing to the industry of these people. In other words, oppressed peoples of Europe had become people of acclaim in North America. In ensuing decades, as Pennsylvania and the other 12 Atlantic seaboard colonies achieved independence from Britain to become the United States, the Amish community's unique identity became less apparent to outside observers, who generally placed them within the larger category of Pennsylvania Dutch, which is this misleading term to designate all descendants of Deutsch, German, immigrants, but the term was corrupted to Dutch as opposed to Deutsch, so the Pennsylvania Dutch. In his famous 1789 account of Pennsylvania Dutch life in Lancaster and other southeastern Pennsylvania counties, Philadelphia physician and signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, made no distinctions among religious groups as he praised the area's lush farms and the family labor that created them. So he was praising all German-speaking peoples and not singling out the Amish. But in particular, he praised the work of German-speaking women. He celebrated the large vegetable gardens German-speaking women tended, praised the field labor they performed alongside husbands and sons at harvest time, and noted that their families rejoiced equally in the birth of what he called every new milkmaid daughter and plowman son. It was only in the early decades of the 20th century that the Amish way of life began to strike observers as noticeably different from that of their neighbors, and this was sparked by developments in the mid-19th century. First, there were disagreements over religious doctrine, which caused nonconformist Amish to break away from the traditionalists, the traditionalists who continued to hew closely to the theology and practices their ancestors had brought from Europe in the 18th century. These traditionalists, who were now referred to as the Old Order Amish, remained adamant that they separate from the rest of the world. This included rejection of most of the new technologies produced by 19th century industry, including agricultural, household, communication, and transportation technologies. By the early 20th century, while the Old Order Amish had adopted some new equipment, such as treadle sewing machines and gasoline-powered lamps for the poultry house, they assiduously avoided other technologies that most of their neighbors, including other Amish, were adopting, most especially the gasoline-powered tractor and automobile. In a related development, the Old Order Amish, who to casual observers by the 20th century now stood in for all Amish, the Old Order Amish firmly resisted the separate spheres model of family farming that agricultural experts in the United States Department of Agriculture, or the USDA, were now prescribing. With the industrialization of agriculture, advisors increasingly championed the notion that farm households should become more like bourgeois urban households, with men effectively acting as farm businessmen who specialized in the production of cash-making field crops and the maintenance of livestock, and women acting as full-time homemakers who refrained from farm production. Now, similar developments were occurring in 19th century Germany, where the term Landwirt, farmer or agricultural proprietor, began to replace Hausvater, and the term Hausfrau, or housewife, to replace the term Hausmutter. But this concept of farming as a business was entirely alien to people who believed it was a divinely ordained way of life. To the Old Order Amish, tending farmland was a Christian responsibility, as was passing this sacred way of life to the next generation and the next generation and the next generation after that. So as the result of these developments, by 1930, after living in Pennsylvania for two centuries, the Old Order Amish remained a distinctive group who remained committed to many aspects of the life their ancestors had known. They refused telephones, radios, automobiles, electrical appliances, and birth control devices. At a time when a high school education was becoming a near universal experience in the rest of the northern United States, they refused to send their children beyond the eighth grade in the one-room neighborhood schoolhouse. Members of the faith continued to speak the German dialect known colloquially as Pennsylvania Dutch, and they dressed in a plain manner, with the men sporting beards and flat black hats and the women wearing head coverings and aprons. Most significantly, in a progressively urban, industrial America, the Amish remained committed to an increasingly old-style agricultural way of life. They farmed in Lancaster County and in other areas of Amish settlement without the benefit of tractors and continued to rely on the power of horses and mules. So to orient people to the location of Lancaster County in Pennsylvania, again, if conveniently, marked it in red on this map, and then this photograph is a photograph of a typical Amish farmstead in the late 1930s. So at a time when farmers were increasingly specializing in production of a few major cash crops, the Old Order Amish remained committed to small-scale mixed-crop agriculture. Old Order men and women believed that the Bible sanctioned this devotion to an agrarian way of life, just as it did their other distinctive practices. As a Lancaster County Amish man told cultural geographer Walter M. Cole Morgan in 1940, and according to Cole Morgan, this is what the Old Order man said to him, "The Lord told Adam to replenish the earth and to rule over the animals and the lands, and you can't do that in cities." So the distinctive practices that the Old Order Amish continued to maintain at the time of Cole Morgan's research in the 1930s and early 1940s made them attractive research subjects for Cole Morgan and other social scientists affiliated with President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Cole Morgan's employer was the USDA's Bureau of Agricultural Economics, and this was just one of many federal organizations that sent investigators to the home of Pennsylvania's largest Amish community, Lancaster County. So many New Deal social scientists and others affiliated with the New Deal were traveling to Lancaster County in the 1930s and the early 1940s. And in particular, a couple of the New Deal agencies that had a major presence in Lancaster County during the New Deal era were the Works Progress Administration and the Farm Security Administration. A major goal of the investigations that were undertaken by these New Deal agencies was to assess how effectively the Old Order Amish, with their reliance on labor-intensive agriculture and rejection of modern consumer culture, to discover how they were weathering the Great Depression. Across the board, these studies found that the 18th century practices of the Old Order Amish served them well during the economic crisis of the 1930s. In his report, in fact, which was published in 1942, the aforementioned cultural geographer, Walter Cole Morgan, determined that the Old Order Amish of Lancaster County were the most stable rural community of the Depression era in the United States. Now, one of the most extensive New Deal investigations of Lancaster County Amish took place as part of the 1935-1936 Study of Consumer Purchases, or SCP, which was under the auspices of the USDA's Bureau of Home Economics and the Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics. SCP organizers selected families in large and small cities, villages, and farming communities throughout the country for exhaustive analysis using very detailed questionnaires. Lancaster County was among the 66 farm counties included in the study, and survey workers collected questionnaires from over 1,200 farm families in the county of Lancaster, and that included 105 Old Order Amish families. Now, survey investigators, wherever they were doing their research across the map of the United States, approached the women, the adult women of the families who participated in the studies, in the study of consumer purchases. They approached the women to gain information about their household spending habits, as well as data about farm crops and income, farm and household equipment, family size, home production, recreational practices, and dietary habits. Now, these were supposed to be anonymous surveys. No one was supposed to be able to be identified by ethnicity. But this proved a problem, particularly on this portion of the survey schedule. The page that asked about recreational practices. And so there were all of these questions about how often do you go to the movies, when did you buy your radio, do you go joyriding in your car through the countryside, and of course, for the Old Order Amish, the survey takers were leaving that section of the survey blank. So they had to explain why there were no answers to these questions, and so the comments you see at the top of this page of the survey were quite typical. This is an Amish family whose belief prohibit paid for recreation. So that is how I identified the 105 families that were Amish families in these supposedly anonymous surveys. Well, as the SCP data indicate, Amish adherence to the farming practices of the early modern era yielded very positive results. In the mid-1930s, when the average Lancaster County family netted $878 a year from cash crops and livestock on a farm that would be 60.5 acres, which is 24.5 hectares, Old Order Amish families realized a $1,000 profit on farms of about the same size. On average, the Amish farm is 61.4 acres or 24.8 hectares. So their farm size is about the same. Yet, compared to the county average, the Old Order Amish have much more profitable farming enterprises. And one key to the success of these families was the flexibility of their labor roles. In an amendment of gender roles practiced in early modern Europe and even in colonial Pennsylvania, women no longer predominated in dairy work. As the scale of Amish dairying had grown in the 20th century, it now engaged both classes roughly equally. Women and girls, nevertheless, remained the predominant labor in the home, garden, and especially the poultry house, while men and older boys continued to be in charge of large livestock and cash crops. But at harvest time, with the exception of the very youngest boys and girls, male and female family members all labored in the farm fields. And this slide gives you some indication about Amish women's activities, farm production activities, and how significantly they contributed to the farm family economy and the greater economic success story of the Old Order Amish farms than other farms in Lancaster County. Their intense reliance on family labor encouraged a high Amish birth rate. According to SCP data, while the average Lancaster County farm woman had 2.53 children living at home in 1935-1936, the typical Old Order Amish respondent had 3.34 children living in her household. Old Order Amish theology, as well as the need for family labor, encouraged creation of large families. Following the biblical injunction to be fruitful and multiply, Amish women viewed childbirth as status-enhancing, and they and their husbands considered babies gifts from God rather than extensions of their parents' identities. In the 1930s, just as they had in Benjamin Rush's time in the 1780s, Amish farm families rejoiced in the birth of each baby, regardless of gender. Echoing Rush's observations of 1789, birth announcements in the Amish worker budget emphasized a child's status as a future worker. In autumn 1934, for example, Katie Lapp reported from the Lancaster County community of Gordonville that a little dishwasher named Sarah had arrived at the home of Samuel Blank. Marianne Byler spread the news from Crawford County that the Jake A. Byler household was all smiles since the little woodchopper came to stay with them. He answers to the name of Andrew. So such language emphasized the equally significant role that both boys and girls played as members of the household labor unit. So information unearthed in the SCP surveys indicates that the Amish valued both boys and girls' labor almost without distinction. In a practice familiar to their ancestors in early modern Europe, an Amish family with enough children to spare might send a son or daughter to labor at a neighboring farm where the children were either too young to work or were old enough to marry and leave home. Working at a neighbor's place was an important coming-of-age experience for many Old Order Amish youngsters, providing them with a sense of personal responsibility and a chance to practice the work skills they had learned at home and would soon be taking to their own families as adults. Working on a neighboring farm also provided young people with a wage to take back to their families or to invest in establishing their own households one day. Prevailing wage rates in the county designated male hired labor, which centered on cash crop production in the spring, summer, and fall, as worth more in terms of a wage than household-centered female labor that might occur year-around. But over the course of a year, girls' lighter but more frequent work resulted in wages that were roughly equal to their brothers' earnings. For instance, one 16-year-old Amish girl earned $156, which would translate into $2,851 today, for performing what the SCP survey takers termed household work on farm. And this was work that she did for a neighboring farm family at the rate of $3 a week for 52 weeks. While her 18-year-old brother received $160, only $4 more, or $2,925 in 2019 currency, for doing what was labeled unskilled labor on farm at $20 a month for 8 months. So the girls' wages tended to be by the week, the boys by the month. But in the end, it was a sort of a pay equity situation in terms of, you know, the final wage that a boy or a girl would earn. So I want to focus now specifically on the experiences of a 19-year-old so-called hired girl who was one of these young women who went to a neighboring farm to work. And this is a portion of the SCP survey of the household that she resided in as a so-called hired girl. The experiences of this 19-year-old hired girl and the household she labored in offer both insight into the value of female labor and the imprecision of the term household work on farm. In 1935-1936, this young woman worked on a 55-acre, which would be a 22.3-hectare, general farm that was rented by a 30-year-old wife and 29-year-old husband who had a 5-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter. The farm wife reported to SCP agent Viola J. Hambright that the main activities of her son and daughter were playing and sleeping. With children too young to labor on the farm, the Amish couple hired both farm, or male, and household, or female, labor. Due to Amish skepticism of outsiders, including the belief that they lacked the training, strength, and perseverance to work successfully on Amish farms, the youngsters the couple hired were likely Amish. The couple reported paying just $25 for farm labor, which suggests that they only hired male help during the busiest weeks in the farm calendar, such as during the wheat harvest and at haying time. In contrast, the young woman that Hambright classified, who Hambright was the SCP agent, who classified this young laborer as the couple's hired girl, apparently worked throughout the spring, summer, and fall, earning the going rate of $3 a week. In total, she received $105, and that would translate into today's currency as $1,922, as well as her room and board for the 35 weeks she worked on the farm. Although Hambright listed the 19-year-old's daily labor as housework, the fact that her employers did not require the young woman's services during the winter months indicates the extent to which her work was tied to the household's farming tasks. While the household's wife and mother worked in the garden, poultry house, dairy barn, and farm field, the hired girl washed dishes, dusted, swept, and kept an eye on the children. When her female employer processed fruits, meats, and vegetables for market sale or home consumption, the hired girl assisted her. In the winter months, however, when the woman's gardening, canning, and field work were done, her small household did not require the services of a hired female laborer. The SCP data that Hambright compiled demonstrate the impressive results of the work that the hired girl and her female employer performed. During Hambright's late November 1936 visit, the household consumed an extensive list of vegetables and fruits that the farm woman had raised and had canned with the hired girl's assistance, and that included fresh cabbage and apples and canned green beans, tomatoes, carrots, beets, pickles, and applesauce. The fact that the hired girl was still residing with her employers during the last full week of November indicates that she continued to provide assistance while the wife and husband did the late autumn hog butchering and processing that provided the household with hams, sausages, and something called pudding pork, which was head and organ meat that was ground up and made into a food item that had the consistency of an American-style pudding. And while the hired girl did the housework and minded the children, the farm wife devoted time to the family's poultry and dairy operations, which provided food for both the household and the market, and earned the household a gross income of $195 in chicken, egg, and duck sales, which would be $3,564 in 2019 currency, and a whopping $1,325 in milk sales, which would be $24,219 in 2019. Now, the hired girl and farm wife also played an important role in field crop production. As a petite young woman, 5 feet, 3 inches tall, and 120 pounds, which would be 1 meter, 61 centimeters, and 54 kilograms, her employers would not have allowed her to work with farm horses or the equipment that they powered in the grain and hay fields. But the meals that she and the wife prepared for the male field hands were vital to the male field hands' success during harvest and haying season. And while the hired girl worked indoors, the young farm wife undoubtedly worked alongside her husband and hired male laborers during the handwork, doing the handwork of shocking grain, gathering hay, and harvesting a potato crop that grossed $100, which is $1,828 in 2019. Now, if she was emblematic of other Amish women in the county, the wife and mother also labored in the farm's tobacco fields, helping her husband earn $170 in gross tobacco income, $3,107 in 2019 currency. Tobacco profits accounted for nearly 10% of the family's total income, which was quite typical in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Tobacco was the county's major cash crop, although dairy, poultry, and livestock production provided more of the total farm income. And among all the counties in the state of Pennsylvania, Lancaster County produced 90% of the state's tobacco crop. So I would argue that tobacco was the quintessential Amish crop. The Columbian exchange of crops between the Americas and Europe meant that their ancestors were cultivating this so-called New World crop in the Palatinate long before the Amish left that region for their new life in Pennsylvania. And the Amish were particularly attracted to tobacco farming because it was not dependent upon the purchase and use of gasoline-powered farm equipment. And stripping, sorting, and baling the crop took place during the winter months, which were devoid of major field tasks. So the Amish especially prized tobacco as a crop that kept boys from being idle in the winter. But tobacco also kept Amish mothers and daughters busy in other months of the year, busy weeding with hoes in the summer and harvesting the crop with hand shears in late August and September. While the average Lancaster County farm raised a tobacco crop worth $398 in 1935-1936, the typical Old Order Amish household raised a crop valued at $460, so significantly more profitable tobacco crop on the Amish farms. All told, with her labor in the farm's tobacco and potato fields and its poultry and dairy operations, the 30-year-old wife contributed to cash earnings of $1,790, which was 63% of the household's gross farm sales of that year. The joint efforts of this woman and the hired girl she supervised were impressive, and they made a significant economic impact on their household. But Amish women's contributions to the family economy increased noticeably as their families grew older, larger, and moved up the agricultural ladder from farm renters to farm owners. And the experiences of a middle-aged woman whose family the same SCP agent, Viola Hambright, visited in September 1936 are illustrative. And this is a page from the survey schedule for this particular family that was headed by a 50-year-old wife and a 47-year-old husband. They owned a 78-acre or 31.6-hectare farm that the SCP characterized as primarily a livestock, dairy, and poultry operation. The household included 19, 11, and 9-year-old sons and 16, 15, and 13-year-old daughters. Now, the three youngest children were still in school, but the other three had already graduated from the eighth grade and were full-time participants in the farm family economy. The family did not employ any hired labor. From Thursday, 17 September, through Saturday, 19 September, and again from Monday, 21 September, through Wednesday, 23 September, the two older daughters spent 8 hours a day picking tomatoes. Now, if their father or older brother worked alongside the two girls in the tomato fields, Hambright simply subsumed this male labor under the general heading farming. With her older sisters in the field, this left the family's 13-year-old daughter as her mother's only household helper on a Saturday that apparently included a weekend house guest. This 21-year-old visitor, who was most likely the 21-year-old daughter listed elsewhere in the survey as the family's eldest child, arrived from her week of teaching in a one-room school or maybe working as a hired girl on a neighboring farm to reap the benefits of the tomato picker's diligent labor. A typical day's meal during the time of this house guest visit included fried tomatoes at noon and fresh sliced tomatoes for supper. In total, during the week that Agent Hambright visited the family, they consumed 17 and a half pounds of tomatoes, and that is 7.9 kilograms. If indeed their young visitor was the family's oldest daughter, she may even have arrived specifically to help with tomato canning. During Hambright's visit, a report published in this Amish newspaper I've referred to previously, The Budget, a report in The Budget noted that the women in Lancaster County were busy canning tomatoes and making catsup to use up the tomatoes, which were very plentiful that summer. So during the week of Hambright's visit, the Amish woman and her family were also busy harvesting potatoes. According to budget correspondence, as a result of dry September weather, which was in favor of potato and tomato picking, potatoes were in large supply. Like tobaccos, potatoes were one of those new world crops that had made it to the other side of the Atlantic, and the Amish ancestors had grown in Europe for generations. And they were a crop whose cultivation required the labor of all family members. While a budget reporter characterized local men folks as very busy picking tomatoes and taking out potatoes, it was actually their wives and children who were providing most of the labor at this time of year in the tomato and potato fields when men were busy harvesting corn, filling silos, and making hay. At the time of Hambright's visit, families throughout Lancaster County were busy harvesting, eating, processing, and selling potatoes. One Amish woman reported earning $130 from the sale of her homemade potato chips alone. The family that Hambright surveyed listed fried potato on their sample breakfast and supper menus and boiled potatoes at the noon meal. So they were eating even more potatoes than they were tomatoes. But even if they ate potatoes at every meal for 7 days, the family could not have consumed the 84 pounds, that would be 38 kilograms, of potatoes that they reported having on hand during the survey week. Rather than eating the majority of this produce themselves, family members obviously sold potatoes as one of their cash crops. In fact, another survey agent visiting earlier in the year had ranked potatoes second only to wheat as an income-producing crop for this particular Old Order Amish family. While the family made $120 selling their 150-bushel wheat crop at 80 cents a bushel, they earned two-thirds that amount, or $80, by selling 200 bushels of potatoes at 40 cents a bushel. The mainstays of the family's economy were their livestock, dairy, and poultry operations. Their livestock enterprise, under the purview of the father and 19-year-old son, included the sale of 27 steers at $65 a head, two calves at $10 a piece, and one horse for $50. In total, the family grossed $1,825 in livestock sales. They apparently raised livestock strictly for the market because the survey recorded no butchering activities or consumption of home-produced meat. Hambright instead noted that the household patronized a local butcher shop to procure the cured ham, beef bologna, and dried beef that they consumed during the third week of September 1936, the week of her visit, of Hambright's visit. In contrast, the family's dairy venture, which engaged both male and female labor, and its poultry operation, which employed female labor, produced for both the market and home consumption. Without benefit of electric-powered milking machines or incubators, the family conducted their dairy and poultry enterprises with great efficiency. Although they only ran their dairy for one half of the 1935-1936 survey year, the family nevertheless grossed $780 in annual milk sales. And while they averaged $15 in milk sales per week, they also averaged $1.40, or 28 quarts, that would be 26.5 liters, in their own consumption of their own milk. Their sample meal menus listed milk as a beverage at every meal, and they spread home-produced butter on their homemade bread three times a day. But it was the family's poultry operation that was the real mainstay of the farm economy. During the survey year, they sold 7,200 dozen eggs at 30 cents a dozen to gross $2,160 in egg income, and they grossed another $300 in chicken sales. In addition, the family themselves consumed two chickens per month and five dozen eggs a week. Hambright, in fact, listed fried eggs as the main course on the family's sample supper menu. So I think this slide pretty much tells the story. Of the two major cash-producing enterprises the family engaged throughout the survey year, the poultry operation, a female endeavor, outstripped their large livestock business, a male undertaking, The annual gross profit for egg and chicken sales combined stood at $2,460, which is $44,965 in 2019 currency, which outpaced large livestock sales by $635, or $11,607 in 2019. Poultry production costs were significantly lower than those for cattle operations, so net profit, as well as gross income, was higher for the family's poultry business than their livestock enterprise. In reporting their farming expenses for the survey year, the family listed $300 in expenses on chicken feed and $32.50 for 5 new gasoline lamps for the chicken house and $200 for the gasoline that powered the chicken house lamps. In total, poultry production costs were $532.50, making a net profit of $1,927.50 for the family's poultry business. In contrast, livestock investments were notably higher. According to the family's own reporting, the main monetary investment in their beef operation was the purchase of the 27 steers themselves at $37 a head, for a total outlay of $999. The family listed $200 in dairy feed expenses, but reported no feed costs for their beef cattle, suggesting that the steers primarily ate their farm's own grains, hay, and grass, and maybe through some type of neighborhood arrangement, the cattle perhaps had periodic access to the pasture land of a neighboring farmer farms. Once fattened, the cattle sold for $65 a head, netting the family $756 in beef profits. Again, translating the difference here, that was $1,171.50 less than their poultry profits. In addition to its lower investment costs, poultry production made better use of the family labor force. By the age of 5 or so, a young child could scatter chicken feed and collect eggs, whereas working with large livestock was physically impractical and dangerous for someone so young. The cost and labor efficiency of the female-managed poultry operation thus made the poultry operation the real centerpiece of the Amish farm economy. And on average, poultry profits for the old order Amish outpaced those of non-Amish households, significantly outpaced them throughout Lancaster County. Now, while Agent Hambright listed housework as the primary activity of this particular household's wife and mother, her labor extended well beyond that. Household maintenance was indeed a component of her work. With varying levels of assistance from her already busy daughters, she cleaned the house without benefit of a vacuum cleaner or indoor running water. She cooked, baked, and did the laundry with old-fashioned coal, wood, or gasoline-powered equipment. She mended the distinctive old order Amish garments that she constructed on her pedal-powered sewing machine, and she tended to any minor illnesses or injuries. Yet she also canned tomatoes, milked cows, supervised the hen house, and harvested potatoes, allowing her husband and children to live and prosper even in the middle of an economic depression. Now, Amish families were not unique in the 1930s, as many of you know. Even in the face of these prescriptions to adopt the role of housefrau, homemaker. Out of economic necessity, millions of farm women throughout the United States stepped up their production activities and decreased their reliance on purchased goods. Farm communities in many regions witnessed a substantial increase in women's gardening and poultry raising activities in the 1930s as compared to the 1920s. By the 1930s, however, most of these women's families were in a period of transition between the general family farming practices of an earlier era and the crop specialization, farm mechanization, and consumer culture participation that farm journals, equipment manufacturers, agricultural colleges, and many within the USDA prescribed. Once the economy recovered, most farm women and their families would continue on the path toward greater capital investment, mechanization, specialization, and consumerism. Over time, this path led to prosperity for some and failure for others. For the Old Order Amish, in contrast, productive activities represented a continuation rather than a resumption or extension of earlier practices. The Old Order Amish belief that the Lord had commanded them to lead a labor-intensive life on the land lay behind their strong, sustained, and highly successful commitment to production activities involving all members of the farm family. Hard work distracted family members from worldly influences outside the Amish community, and home production and consumption of their own farm products ensured that members of the Old Order Amish, with their history of religious persecution, could remain relatively self-reliant and independent of potentially dangerous outsiders. For Old Order Amish women, their extensive role in farm production was not a temporary survival strategy in economic hard times, but a permanent way of life. As the SCP data indicate, women's long-established and wide-ranging production efforts and their limited involvement in consumer activities helped Amish families weather depression conditions more successfully than the majority of other farm families and allowed them to maintain a stable life on the land for decades to come. Now, budget correspondents may have reported the local tomato and potato harvests as strictly work for the men folks, and government agents may have classified the work of Amish wives and mothers as simple housekeeping, but the SCP data indicate the story of Old Order Amish family farming as being much more complex. Rejecting the separate spheres prescriptions of 19th and 20th century experts on both sides of the Atlantic, who counseled that farm women retreat from farm production to become full-time homemakers, the Amish maintained the practice that 17th century advisor Wolf Helmhard von Holberg had once described as helping one another harmoniously. While their rhetoric upheld the notion of a rigidly patriarchal labor system in which men alone performed cash-making outdoor work, Amish families' real-life labor and cash-earning experiences represent a different reality and demonstrate the interwoven nature of women's work and men's work and family life and family labor on the Amish farm. The SCP data also demonstrate the extent to which the Old Order Amish continued the agricultural practices and gender role arrangements that their ancestors had transferred from West Central Europe to Mid-Atlantic North America in the early 18th century. The gender roles of the early modern Palatinate translated well to 20th century Pennsylvania. Merci beaucoup for being a wonderful audience. I have been advised by both Gerard and Federico that if you want to ask me any questions, it's cocktail time, so do it over drinks.